Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 6th of
August,
1998. In the Creekside room this morning is Chuck Schaefer. Today's session number is 98.3, and it's titled A Book Review of Mata Gari by Nuktwa Thiong'o. Let's listen in.
Well, Mata Gari, and it's in the bookstore in this form. I think I requested a paperback from the Heinemann African Writers series, but somehow they got this one, which is a little bit more expensive, but I think it would be a good investment for you if you were so inclined. So it's at the bookstore. But in any case, what I want to do today is look at this novel, look at a number of themes that come out of the novel, building on one of the themes that I was talking about yesterday, and that is that the language Kikuyu, in which he writes in, was so shaped by the missionary Bible translators that it's really hard for him to go beyond the sort of the idioms and metaphors of biblical idioms and metaphors, and really sort of conceive of his novel in sort of African parlance, and he really doesn't do that. And I think so. When I read this article and was putting these things together, I immediately sort of thought of this book as an illustration of that point that I made yesterday. But I also want to do a number of other things, and one is sort of go through the story without telling the end of it. And then also introduce you a little bit to some of the major themes and some I think exceptional authors, African authors, so with no more ado, let me turn your sort of heads over here to the blackboard and go through a few of these authors and sort of highlight some of their books and the themes that they sort of pick up on. Perhaps the most read book in African studies is Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe. I would imagine that more Americans, I was going to say white Americans, but I think more Americans, African Americans and white Americans have probably read Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart than all other African books combined. I'm always struck. I go to universities and they want to diversify the reading syllabus. They want to bring in something from Africa. The thing they bring in is Things Falling Apart. It's a fabulous book, though. But because it's so often used, I feel in sort of obliged to find other things to introduce them to I think, equally good books. But it's hard to really surpass Things Fall Apart. Things Fall Apart briefly is about Obi, who is a huge bull of a man living in Nigeria. He has village recognition because he was a wrestler and defeated other wrestlers from other villages. And his psyche is about as bullish as his physique. In other words, he's not prone to change. Things conspire. Pretty soon you have glimpses of a white man. It sounds like he's either a census taker or a colonial administrator who passes through. They make reference to a bicycle, and then later on in the book, a missionary comes and sets up a school not far, and Obi's son is this very petite, effeminate person who doesn't have his father's respect and is sort of shunned by the village. The son feels like an outcast, and he goes to the mission and gets education. So you can see sort of the beginning of the tension there, the influence of colonialism on the rubric of pre-colonial African society. Well, in any case, I'm not going to go on because it's a tragic story, really. Other sort of elders of the village are able, more amenable to change. Obi is not, and in the final analysis, he dies the death of a tragic hero, perhaps. His grandson is the main character in No Longer at Ease. And so things fall apart is at the dawn of colonialism, and No Longer at Ease is at the end of colonialism, where this kid is educated in Europe. The whole village pools their money, sends them to Europe, and they come back. They expect great things because of his sort of patron clientage, and it just doesn't happen. He finds that the pressures of living a modern life, the bank account, all of the taxes, all of the things that a respected bureaucrat is supposed to have, including a car, just sap his money, and he's not able to feed a sufficient amount back to the village. So again, it's tragedy, but tragedy in modern guise. Time on the Cross, again, like many of the other books that Chinua Achebe is writing now, is about post-colonial Africa and how, with great enthusiasm, they ushered in this new period. They thought that they could transform the continent and develop it. And then what do you have? You have the emergence of military dictators and other oppressors who are keeping the people down. So really, Time on the Cross, Sands of the Savannah, and other novels that he has recently read are more condemnations of the political, social order, economic order in Africa now. Ferdinand Oyuno, he's one of my favorite, and I use these two books, or sort of interchangeably, to introduce what colonialism is all about instead of Things Fall Apart. Houseboy is another tragic African who just sort of perchance is hired in a house and a household, a French household in Cameroon. And what it graphically shows is the process of oppression that Africans receive, but also the process, how colonialism also brutalizes or makes brutal the colonizer. The main character, white character, is the man of the house. His wife comes from France. She's so thin, sympathetic to Africans, and yet slowly, you see by the end of the story, she's the most tyrannical of all the people. She has become racist. And certainly, France Fanon in Wretched of the Earth and Black Skin, White Masks really hits this on the nail. He's sort of, and Emile César on Discourse on Colonialism, they talk about how the white becomes a Nazi towards the black. How essentially colonialism, with just the fact that one group of people are put over another people based on race, slowly changes their character and makes them oppressors, despite the best will that they might have. And so these books are very good. Also, The Old Man and the Metal parrots many of those same themes, but I think The Old Man is just more naive. He's just banted around by circumstances. But again, it shows what colonialism does and how it dehumanizes the African. Well, Ngugi Wa Thiong, the book we're reading right now, and other books that he has written, are sort of take up from Chinua's No Longer at Ease to Chinua's other books about current situation. Perhaps Ngugi Wa Thiong's most famous book is Weep Not Child. It's about the Mau Mau rebellion and what it does in terms of of the Africans. So you hardly in this book you hardly even see the white forces. You hardly are taken to Nairobi. You're out in the bush, and you find out what a civil war and rebellion really means in terms of the disintegration of community and the different aims of the various people. Petals of Blood is one of his more recent books and a very well-known book. And again, this is a condemnation of the current regime in Kenya, which is essentially a dictator in the pocket of multinationals. It's neo-colonialism par excellence. Many prognosticators feel that Kenya is going to blow up one of these days. And, you know, I haven't taken bets on it yet. I learned my lesson with Ethiopia. I used to take bets and say, you know, okay, this regime's going to fall this year. I know it. And then I'd lose my money. So I no longer do that. But political scientists are really predicting that the income disparities between rich and poor in Kenya are so great, and that the mass of Kenyans are way down in the impoverished level, and that there will be social unrest there shortly. And so they are predicting things. And Ngugi Wa Thiong'o is at the forefront. He has been put in prison many times. He has been censured. On this book and on the very back of it, I didn't even know this, but listen to this. It says, soon after Matagiri's publication, its hero was mistaken by the paranoid dictatorial government of Kenya. That's the current government of Daniel Arap Moi, as a revolutionary agitator plotting to overthrow the government, which promptly issued a warrant for his arrest. When the ensuing intensive search across the country finally revealed that Montagiri was only a fictional hero, the book which had given birth to this phantom, this Montagiri, was immediately confiscated and banned from circulation. Now, I'm not sure whether that is true, because I haven't really heard that before, but I think it does sort of communicate the paranoia with which this current government has. But in any case, that's sort of a brief introduction to some of the African literature. There's lots of literature about South Africa. Most of it deals with apartheid. And so it's really hard to put that into the context of the rest of Black Africa. You have to make allowances, and thus I haven't included that. But there's some incredibly good books. One is by Peter Abrams called Mine Boy. And it was the first Black novel written by a Black African. I think it was published in 1942, and it talks about what it was like to be recruited off of the veld and come into these big mine cities and go down into these shafts, live in these slums, and the community that emerges within the context of the shanty towns and slums like Soweto and Sharpsville, etc. But that's sort of a whole other discourse. In any case, Matagiri is a very interesting book. Matagiri, his full name is Matagiri Ngurungi, I think. I should have my wife who knows Swahili pronounce these, but in any case, that's his name. And what it really means is the patriot who survived the bullets. He does survive the Mau Mau. In fact, he survives all somewhere up into the 70s or 80s. He's like one of those Japanese World War II fighters who hides out in the force of New Guinea or something and then reemerges. Well, that's the kind of sense you get here. He was hiding out in the hills. But he comes to a river, he looks over at the fields beyond. That is civilization. The river is the barrier. He says, you know, I need to bury my weapons. And so he buries his weapons in the earth by this big tree, and he peels off a little bit of bark, which symbolizes the belt of peace. He puts that around him, and he walks across the river towards civilization. He comes to a road, and you can sort of see the naivete, and he looks at this road. What is this pavement? Whoa. And right across the road is a Mercedes, where two people are copulating in the back seat, but never mind that. But the radio is blaring, and it's talking about, it's from the Minister of Peace and the Minister of Truth and Justice, talking about what the Great Canyon should be doing. Well, he walks down the road, and he's looking for his family. He wants to go back to his land that a white settler has taken. And he's trying to find his family. I handed some of these things out. One of you has something that says injustice. The rest, it's not on the rest of yours. You just have to listen. I was trying to say for paper. If you could read, and we'll get into that a little bit.
Okay. You see, I built the house with my own hands, but Settler Williams slept in it, and I would sleep outside on the veranda. I tended the estate that spread around the house for miles. But it was Settler Williams who took home the harvest. I was left to pick anything he might have left behind. I worked all the machines and all the industries, but it was Settler Williams who would take the profits to the bank, and I would end up with the cent that he flung my way. I am sure that you already know all this. I produced everything on that farm with my own labor, but all the gains went to Settler Williams. What a world! A world in which the tailor wears rags, the tailor eats wild berries, the builder begs for shelter. One morning I woke up from the deep sleep of many years, and I said to him, Settler Williams, you who eat what another has sown, hear now the sound of the trumpet and the sound of the horn of justice. The tailor demands his clothes, the tiller his land, the worker the produce of his sweat. The builder wants his house back. Get out of my house. You have hands of your own, you cruel and greedy one. Go build your own. Who deceived you into thinking that the builder has no eyes, no head, and no tongue?
I'll just try to paraphrase the next couple paragraphs. And from this, you know, sort of great sort of soliloquy, this great confrontation with Settler Williams, he then goes on and confronts them. They have a little bit of a fight, I believe, and then Settler William rushes to the telephone to call in for help. At that point, Matagari finds Settler Williams' pistol, is about to shoot him, and John Boy, isn't it John Boy?
Yeah.
So. John Boy, who is the kitchen's, who works in the kitchen, another African who works in the kitchen, jumps on him, and he realizes that he can't defeat two quite large men. He jumps up, he runs out the window, and that's when he becomes a guerrilla fighter with Mau Mau against Settler Williams. But I think that gives you sort of an idea of why he decided to rebel, that he wants justice, that he sees all the disparities in this colonial world. Well, in any case, he continues along on his path, looking for his family, never finds them. But he does make a family. In one scene, shortly thereafter, he's just shocked that here he goes into a city. He's never really seen cities. And he's seen all sorts of dispossessed children, boys and girls, orphans who don't have families, who live on garbage heaps. And he goes there, and within this sort of anarchical world of the garbage heap, those kids who are strong and brutal rule, and those who are weak are always, you know, beaten and kicked around. And there's this one little boy who is being kicked around. He stands in front of them against the bullies, subdues the bullies, and takes this little kid as his own. So that's the beginning of his family. The second member of the family is a prostitute. And her 11th command, well, let me tell you a little bit about her, because she's a fabulous character. Her father is a born-again Christian minister. He pounds the Ten Commandments into his children. She takes them up and believes in them to the point where, at a certain point, her father comes under suspicion of these cruel police, and he is being tortured and threatened to be killed. But she has the power to save him if she will go to bed with one of these police. In other words, be raped to save her father. She refuses because the commandment says, thou shalt not commit adultery. Sixth, I think, isn't it? I forget which one. And so she doesn't, but her father dies. She, you know, loses her faith, but she makes another 11th commandment, and that is that she will never sleep with a policeman. Out of circumstance, she becomes a prostitute, but she never sleeps with a policeman. And this aggravates a certain policeman. He comes and he's about to brutalize her, and again, Matagari stands in front of him, and the policeman has this big old German Shepherd police dog, and Matagari utters some words. The police dog sort of cowers, the policeman backs up, and other Africans see this. And then she, of course, is very beholden to them, and they have all sorts of conversations. The third person that makes up the nucleus of his new family is a student who is becoming a union worker. And here, the guy is sort of depressed. He doesn't really quite know what to do. And in conversation with Matagiri, he is given sort of answers to his problems. So what do these three kids really symbolize? The young orphan boy is justice, the prostitute represents strength of Matagiri, and the student union worker represents sort of the wisdom of Matagiri, the strength and bravery of Matagiri. So they become his family, his community. Can one of you who has, I think, the section on individualism read that?
I have it. An education?
Yeah, individualism. Education.
You make your E, capital E's, just like my son David. Listen to me carefully. Mazee, M-Z-E-E.
Mazee. Old man.
Old man, okay. Listen to me carefully, Mazee. I would ask you to learn the meaning of the word individual. Our country has remained in darkness because of the ignorance of our people. They don't know the importance of the word individual as opposed to the word masses. White people are advanced because they respect that word and therefore honor the freedom of the individual, which means the freedom of everyone to follow his own whims without worrying about the others. Survival of the fittest. But you black people, you walk about fettered to your families, clans, nationalities, people, masses. If the individual decides to move ahead, he is pulled back by the others. What's the meaning of the word masses? Mazee, let me tell you what belongs to the masses is carried in a bottomless pail. How does the song go? Go your way and let me go mine, for none of us is carrying the other. My father knew this. That's why he sent me to school and ignored the idiots who were mumbling nonsense about sharing the last bean. Wonders will never cease. Don't you remember how people contributed money to send you to study? Has nobody ever told you? Don't you remember that you intellectuals are greatly indebted to the very masses whom you are now calling idiots?
Sort of lot of twists and turns there. But this is sort of extracted from a conversation that Matagari is having with another sort of character of the book. And I think it sort of sets in contrast, in stark contrast, sort of this new cosmopolitan African who looks and even speaks to other Africans as, what did he refer to him, black person, you black people, or something?
I'm not sure where
you are. Yeah, sort of at the beginning, right? You know, he's referring to them as...
Because of ignorance of our people. They don't know the word individual as opposed to the word masses. White people are advanced. But you black people, you are fettered to your clan.
I mean, it really goes with Franz Fanon's title, Black Skin, White Masks. Mm-hmm. This person has been educated, is so co-opted by modernity and about, you know, by capitalism and whatever it is that constitutes this new modern world, that he's able to say to somebody with the same skin color as he, you black people, with a little bit of derision in it, you know? Ooh, this is... So, but I think what this also does set up is the counterpoint, which is that Matagiri is really looking for his family, for his people, for a community. And this is what this whole book of Matagiri is all about. From there, through various tricks and this, that, and the other, Matagari finds himself in prison with 11 other people. And it's quite interesting. While he's in prison, his name is sort of bantered around. People aren't really quite sure who he is or what he's doing, but he has a reputation by now as being somebody who's actually standing up to the establishment. And so in one phrase, they're eating, there's very little, and then he says, our people, let us share this bean and this drop of wine. And you almost, I hope those biblical metaphors are almost hitting you over the head. Later on, Matagiri took the food, broke it, and gave it to them. Later on here, the drunkard, in sort of with derision and mockery, baptizes him as the name, just like John the Baptist baptized Christ. But this is all mockery. The other 11 have heard about him and see that he's this old mze, this old frail little person, and are just throwing this, heaping all this verbiage and all this symbolism on him, but in total derision and mockery. In any case, this all changes. In the middle of the night, they hear footsteps towards the door of the prison. They think, that must be the police. But the police always come with dogs and flashlights. What's the difference? And then they hear a key in the lock. The door opens. This black figure says, you are all free, but Mze Matagiri, you are supposed to go and to the clinic and wait there. So all of them leave. There's allusions to Paul, to some of Paul's fleeing from prison. You know, I think the jail master has sort of conversion, repentance, and he opens the door and let Paul and I forget who was traveling with Paul at that time, but maybe. But it's so reminiscent of the biblical stories. And I think this is where the myth of Matagiri begins. He's becoming deified. Let me just read just a bit here.
Could I just ask you, is this set in modern day?
Yeah.
This one is. Is this the one that is the book that's banned?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. He says, from that night, Motagiri's fame spread over all the country. He became a legend. He became a dream. Still, the question remained: who was Motagiri? So, you know, it's almost messianic. You know, we're not quite sure who this guy is. But on another couple pages, someone confronts him and says, "Are you the savior of the African people?" And almost like Christ, he responds, "You have said it." You know, denial, but not quite denial, saying, "Well, you know, you've said it. I'm not saying it, but certainly you said it." So I think here it ties in with what I was talking about last time. Ngugi Wa Thiong is this incredibly bright person, but he is writing in Kikuyu to the Kikuyu people in sort of language, metaphors, and stories that they know now in the 80s. And what are those stories that they know in the 80s? They are biblical stories. They are not old stories from Kikuyu legend. They are, you know, the Judaic Christian stories. And so he has to wrap his whole story that he wants the Kikuyu people to read in their own vernacular within the garb of sort of Judaic Christian thought and image. And so that's what he's doing. But then he's also using a lot of biblical ideas of injustice here in this story to make the African sort of think again about some of the injustices that they are suffering. I think someone has one that says maybe neo-colonialism.
Mine says critique of capitalism.
Okay, let me find where that is. I think I want you to read that.
Could you read page 49? Is it the last part cut off on the last few words at the edge of it?
Okay.
So I have to make them up here.
I didn't realize that.
"I am a worker," he began his tale. "I have worked with the company for ages, and the words Motagiri has just spoken are absolutely true. I have been a servant to those machines all my life. Look at how the machines have sapped me of all strength. What is left of me? Just bones. My skin withered even as I kept on assuring myself, a fortune for him who works hard finally comes. A person who endures finally overcomes. What can I now expect when I retire? Just a clock as a thank you for long and loyal service. My fortune? Old age without a pension. Do you know something else? I spent all those years opposed to strikes. I kept on saying, if I go on strike and lose my job, what will my children eat tomorrow? But look at me. Here I am in prison for no reason whatsoever. What went wrong? Let me tell you."
So here Motagiri is out, he's beginning to sort of walk around. People are beginning to see him, they're approaching him, they're asking him sort of what are some of the injustices of this new system. And in a very sort of concrete way, he's letting the Africans speak for themselves to sort of articulate the exploitation that they are suffering in this new post-colonial Africa. And from this, he gets into a long critique of America and Great Britain and Unilever and Shell Oil and McDonald's and, you know, all of these sort of corporate multinational companies that seem to be in cahoots not only with the government but with the establishment down to the smaller town or city that he is living in. And he makes this linkage by going back to John Boy. Remember, John Boy was the guy who jumped on him so that he couldn't kill Settler Williams. John Boy was servant to this white master, but the things have changed now. Now John Boy is essentially the largest capitalist, the owner of the factory that one of his newfound sort of family wants to form a strike against. And who is his second in command but Settler Williams' son, Settler Williams Jr. But notice how it's the same oppression, it's just the color of the skins have been reversed. Now the black man is on top and his cohort is this white person, but they are still exploiting the mass of the Africans in the same way. Well, there's a lot of oral sort of comparisons between Mata Gyiri and Jesus Christ. And they're thinking, well, if he escaped from prison, if he's just sort of appeared from nowhere, nobody knows who he is, he doesn't seem to have any family, maybe he is the second coming of Christ. And in fact, they put this into words here. Let me find it, if I can find it now. 81, okay. You're saying, do you mean to say that he's the one prophesied about, the Son of Man? Why not? Let's count. Where is the oldest church in the world? In Ethiopia. Africa, exclamation point. When he was a baby, where did he flee to? Egypt. Africa, explanation. And so they sort of go on and say, well, why not? Why couldn't the second coming of Christ, or Christ's second coming, come to Africa and free the oppressed people there? But then the real story comes out about how he actually was freed from prison. Indeed, the prostitute who he had taken up and who was part of his family decided voluntarily to break her 11th commandment. So she finds the head of the prison, opens her legs to him, in those words, and while they are having sex somewhere, the little boy who he saved from the garbage heap slips in, rummages through the prison leader's pockets, grabs the keys, and is that shadow in the dark that opens up the door that lets Mata Gyiri out. So you see that the whole sort of myth that is emerging is really sort of a selfless act on this woman's part. The analogies to biblical women, I think, are there. Well, all of the 11 are caught. Why? Because in the prison they say, or there is a common sort of expression in Africa that if there are 12 people gathered together, one of those people are going to be a snitch in the government. But since there were only 11 prisoners, they thought they could all speak freely. But there was still a snitch amongst those 11, a Judas amongst those 11. And so after they are free, Mata Gyiri is shunned away to the clinic. All the others try to find their own ways out, and they're all captured. His third family member, the student who is the union leader, is taken up with this and organizes a strike against John Boy's factory. For this, the Minister of Truth and Justice comes to town to put down the strike and also to condemn those 11 who had escaped from prison, and also to warn the people that if they ever encounter Mata Gyiri, they're supposed to fess up and to report his whereabouts to the police. So it gets into this whole idea of oppression and the power of the government. Could somebody read the passage called Keratology?
In fact, it is we who abided by the law who prevented the country from being destroyed. If you look at the situation dispassionately, without the kind of distortion you find with some of those fiction writers, you can see that in those who obeyed the colonial law, who brought about independence, wasn't it only the other day that all in the university professors and specialists in paratology had a history conference? What did they teach us? That according to their research, those who joined hands with colonialists in protecting the law, the loyalists, were really the ones who made the colonialists give us the independence on a platter. I've ordered all those loyalist professors and all holders of PhDs in paratology to be promoted and given permanent professorships.
This sort of, when I first read it, rather struck hard, you know, professors,
coming
history, loyalty, you know, supporting the establishment, the status quo, but I didn't mean to interrupt them.
For these professors are different from those who are always raising a hue and cry about revolution, revolutionary politics, revolutionary socialism, and other foreign ideologies. No, these permanent professors are the ones who know how to obey and abide by the law, how to serve the law. You agree with me, Professor, don't you?
Thank you very much. You know, the minister of truth and justice comes. He's railing against the students and the union workers. He's trying to put down the strike. He has with him all of these professors of paratology that just essentially parrot everything he says about loyalty to the state. But also, in it, you see the collusion between the government and the economic power at this village level. Because in front of everybody, the head of the factory, John Boy, gives a check to 50,000 shillings to this minister of peace and or of justice, truth and justice. A small fraction of this check is supposed to go for a playground for orphans. But a major portion is supposed to be as a benevolent gift to the president. And another little bit smaller portion as a gesture of kindness to the minister of truth and justice for his coming to the town and putting down the strike. And so you can see the emergence of kleptocracy. This is a, you know, kleptomania within Africa. They've sort of used that word and talk about the sort of the new modern regimes as kleptocrats, or the leaders as kleptocrats. They're always taking from the pockets. Mobutu Sese Seko in Zaire is the epitome of that. You know, he took from the United Nations, USAID, he took from NGOs, all of this, the largesse of the West and all this development aid, put it into his pocket, and he bought chateaus in France. He totally decimated the Zairean economy, and you know, what could have been one of the more productive areas of Africa is now in essentially rubble, really. It genuinely is. But I think what he's saying, he's warning against this, kleptocracy. And he's trying to communicate how ideology can be switched around by those in power. Jeff, could you read that last little section on African socialism? How the Minister of Truth and Justice conceptualizes the idea of African socialism.
The ruling party is our party. It is your party. It is the national party. Therefore, this company has given shares to the country, the whole nation. From now onwards, all of you here and even those who are not here have a stake in the company. Now this company is yours. It is ours. It is a national company. This is capitalism with a socialist face, or socialism with a capitalist heart. That is to say, true African socialism. not like that of Karl Marx and Lenin that the students and teachers are always talking about. Let you read that there.
Oh, Makini Watonacha Tamakuni, and that is translated, they shall be dealt with.
Is that
yeah, that was it.
Okay.
So you can see that, you know, ideology, socialism, all of these words are sort of meaningless in the context in which they can be used by those in power to justify what they're doing. And sort of on a sad note, the parrots become more and more evil. And in fact, on somewhere along the line, they become all members of the Kiyama Kira Kathana. And then in abbreviation, he puts KKK. Symbolism there. And later on, in one of their ceremonies, they wear hoods. Oh, wow, sort of hits you over. Doesn't really try to be subtle in this book. And many, I think, African authors sort of follow the same vein. Oftentimes when they're making a major point that they want to make, they make it three times. It's sort of that old oral technique of saying something again, repeating it, and repeating it a third time to enforce the idea behind it. And so certainly Chinua Achebe does that, Oyonwa does that, Kengugi Wathong does that, and they repeat these things. Metaphors come back and again and again, sometimes spaced throughout the book, sometimes right after each other. So he's talking about the KKK, he's talking about these parrots and how they are essentially sacking the country and forcing the people to follow their dictatorial roles. Well, I think this is where he leaves the biblical tradition, the Bible. Because Mategiri, and this is sort of the conclusion I'll make, Mategiri, instead of following a path of nonviolence or civil disobedience, has to flee. There's a nice chase scene in the book. And he flees across the river. Somehow he's able to find, along with the little boy and the prostitute, the student union worker is killed along the way. But these other two, which are now his family, flee across. He digs up the place where he buried his armaments, and he picks up his AK-47. The AK-47, you know, the Kalashnikov, it is the epitome of dictatorial rule, the symbol of dictatorial rule in all of Africa now, and they're widely spread. Just as an aside, has nothing to do with it, but just an aside that came to mind. I was in Yemen, and two summers ago, I went to a market at Shada, which is right along the Saudi Arabian border, and it's one of the biggest open arms markets in the world. And I, you know, always thought, well, Kalashnikov, they're made in Russia or China. Well, there, they were taking me through some of these little stalls, and they say, oh, this Kalashnikov is made in Brazil, this one in Indonesia, this one in Ethiopia, this one in Iran. Everybody, it's such a simplistic design and so foolproof that everybody is making it. And those guns is essentially epitomizes tyranny, I think, in the world as we know it. But in any case, he picks up his Kalashnikov and he is willing to use violence, but he doesn't want to, but he wants to make his points with the backing of armaments. And I think that's where he differs from the biblical tradition, but he sees this, I think it's desperation in the context of present-day Africa. that, you know, how can you fight those multinationals? How can you fight the governments of Daniel Arap Moi, who are supported by the British and the American embassies, who are supported by the South Africans? We need to organize ourselves. We need to take up arms and at least be able and willing to sacrifice ourselves for justice in the context of Africa. I hope I haven't given away too much of the book. But it's an exceedingly interesting book, as so many African novels are. And what I found in teaching African history is I can pontificate at the front of the classroom for a heck of a long time, and then my students sort of go dutifully take a few notes, you know, regurgitate them on the test and something. But if I assign, typically I always assign at least 2 to 3 novels. And they're always nice and short. They're easy to read. They follow. They have a nice plot. There's nothing subtle about them. But they hammer you over the head. And those are the lessons that they remember. And I can, when I read essay exams at the end of the semester, I can see, you know, in dramatic form that the way in which they are sort of interpreting the evidence that sometimes they are assembling to interpret my essay questions are gained right out from these novels, these fictional novels that so enliven the situation in Africa. Yeah, questions?
Where does this author live?
I believe he still lives in Kenya.
Always has.
But I know he's been in prison a couple times. He's been censured. He's been put under house arrest other times. I know a couple times he's fled. But he's one of those real stalwarts that is certain that he wants to live and die in Kenya. And so he's assumed a lot of risk.
Did he go out of Kenya for any education?
Boy, I think he did. I think he went to, yes, he went to, yes, he did. He was educated in Kikuyuland, then he went to Makamira University in Uganda, you know, country right next to him. And then he also got a BA at the University of Leeds in England. But he went back to Kenya almost right away, and his first novel, Weep Not Child, was published in 1964.
Sounds like in some ways Kenya is kind of an intellectual center for a lot of thinking Africans, etc. Are they free to learn, more free to learn there than elsewhere?
Despite the press that he's talking about, the dictatorial regime, The press has remained remarkably free in Kenya. And I think that is simply because a lot of there's a high rate of literacy in Kenya. They just will go underground for a while until their regime changes, and then they'll come above ground again. But yeah.
The infrastructure is there to support it too, as opposed to other countries.
Yeah.
To support education, maybe?
Support everything.
Yeah,
education, transportation.
But it's Kenya that you think is going to blow or have.
Oh, yeah. I'm betting on any predictions about it.
If you want to bet on it in 1999. not at all. It's just that my husband and I do a lot of traveling. And we were in Soviet Union a year before it broke out. We were in South Africa a year before it
broke out.
We were in Yugoslavia only 2 months before the Serbs started fighting. We're going to Kenya in October.
Oh.
So if you,
what are you guys doing?
If you want to do any betting on this.
what's your thought about Tanzania as far as resolution? I thought it was more dangerous.
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. They had their 20 years of African socialism and actually village socialism, Ujamaa socialism under Nyerere. They've walked away from that in the mid 80s. They've made some major sort of changes in the structure. They've allowed a lot more private enterprise and everything to emerge. Per capita income is going, but you know, social stratification is also gaining simply because some Tanzanians are becoming very wealthy. But in Kenya, they never really had the chance to try on a socialism. Mm-hmm. They've always sort of followed the capitalist path. Tanzania has, and I think it's sort of reconciled itself more concretely to the benefits of both systems, and it's trying to feel itself around both, whereas Kenya has emerged, especially under Daniel Arap Moi, into a veritable dictatorship. Mm-hmm. So my brother-in-law, Kathy's brother, lives in Tanzania. He's lived there since 1977. Recently he married a Tanzanian woman. They're going to have their first kid sometime this year. And Kathy and I, if our wallets allowed, would probably take a flight out there every other weekend if we could, because we really do enjoy Tanzania. I mean, it's not perfect. There's no government that is.
Yeah.
And there's an optimism to get ahead too.
Pardon?
People that we've talked about, a lot of them are entrepreneurs, and they. Mm-hmm. My sister-in-law, she says, "Oh, I know if I made these little dolls, I could find marketplaces for them." And the workers who came to Ethiopia, they were floored coming to Ethiopia, going to these ruins of the rock churches, and they said, "No one's selling pot here. It's hot. Someone can make it." You know, and they were just thinking of how to get ahead.
Yeah. And going, I think maybe it was made dramatic for us because we went from Ethiopia to Tanzania, and we just were amazed at sort of the entrepreneurial spirit and vitality of the Tanzanian people. Mm-hmm. Conversely, I think in Kenya, you have an incredibly large capitalist sort of class, but you have a lot of oppression too. And I think the feeling is that that's explosive. Jeff, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I guess I think that's one of the interesting things about the notion of neo-colonialism is that you no longer have that direct the direct presence and the direct oppression, but that in a sense, what I even think of like Antonio Gramsci and some of his concepts of hegemony,
yeah,
where if you can control the ideas and you control the economic means of reproducing those ideas, in essence, that's much more effective than a physical presence in any state.
Yeah.
And so what you have now, and it's interesting, the parallels with Latin America are fascinating, although, interestingly enough, in Latin America, it's the M16. Because when you said I went to the market in Nicaragua, and it's Patriot missiles that you can buy, and it's M16s that you can buy, and all of this stuff. But it's interesting how you have, in a sense, this sort of entrapment, because you have an obliteration of those, the ideas, even the communal ideas and that sort of thing, so that now all you can refer to are capitalism or socialism or the Bible, as the metaphors that are oftentimes used, and so that in a sense it's much more of a control over the possibilities that people feel they can generate for moving on ahead.
Almost a control of a person's imagination.
Yeah. And at the level of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund as well. I mean, it's interesting because one of the things that we saw in Mexico was for the first time, the ejido system, which is a communal land system that goes all the way back to the Maya. It was the World Bank that in essence told the Mexican government that they needed to start changing those. Mm-hmm. And up until then, it was something that not even the Mexican Revolution could touch. You know, so it's kind of interesting to see how some of those forces at that global level can have even more control.
You were talking, Jeff, about the mind control and what this can do. We had an exchange student from Zagreb, Croatia, but it was Yugoslavia at the time when we had her in 1990. And having her being raised in the communist government system, and yet it was a bit of freedom. Her grandfather had a fur shop, kind of, for instance. But the mindset and how she would think of things. We found this in the Soviet Union also, when everybody is a part of the government, everybody's trying to get something of their own. And she said there is no volunteerism. Mm-hmm. And to pursue this further, I remember driving in the car with her just after the earthquake in San Francisco, and the Red Cross was appealing for a lot of money for this, and Vanya just, well, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. And I said, why, Vanya? And she said, well, would you send money? And I said, well, Vanya, I already have. Mm-hmm. Well, it's just stupid. I said, you're going to have to explain this further, Vanya. Why is this stupid to send money? Well, because it will never get to the people who need it. Mm-hmm. Wherever it goes through, because everybody is out to get from the government, which is just kind of this over big umbrella, that nobody would take money and pass it on. She was an avid church-going person, but you never give donations in church because whoever counts the money will take it home. So you never give money to anybody. And to have that mindset, how do you get beyond that? This is, this is generations and generations of education and of working, because it's just not, she just thought we were really stupid the whole time. Nobody would ever volunteer.
But there's also a converse to that in the United States. We also have, we believe in that we have that much more freedom at the individual level, but we have almost no sense of the other in terms of doing things. I mean, that whole quote on the your family dragging you back, and it's interesting teaching students here too that there is this idea that people might deserve something just because they're human beings. Uh-huh. isn't acceptable here.
I mean, also, like, this side of the pond, we have a lot of what? Self-serving nonprofits who are using 85% of the dollar I give to their own promotion.
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
A lot of subtle ways in
that's
which,
right.
In which the overt problems are, mm-hmm. are just not so subtle in other places.
Do you have a sense of for whom the book was truly written? Because he uses so much imagery that's very Western, with all the Christian symbols, and well, although you know, much well,
KKK,
yeah. Quite well educated, but yeah, KKK. Yeah. I was thinking, who would know that? I don't know how well that's known. Yeah,
well, everybody knows about Abe Lincoln. Do they know about the KKK too?
I'm not sure about that. But if it, he did, he only writes in Kikuyu.
Oh.
And all of his books have been translated into English and other languages by other folks. So he's one of a truly small group of African intellectuals who believes that you don't have to, have a named professorship in an American university. Unfortunately, Chinua Achebe has, I think he bumps around from prestigious American university to American university. Wole Soyinka, who received the Nobel Prize also from Nigeria, who's spoken up against Nigeria, I think has a place in London and in New York or something like that. So these folks are on the international stage. Ngugi Wa Thiong is in Kenya, and feeling the wrath of the Kenyan government many more months than not.
Yeah.
And that makes him quite special, I think.